This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 295 of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining us for another episode. We will be talking to Cliff Enzer of Uplander in just a few minutes. I will take a moment to quickly thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making contributions in support of the show to keep these conversations coming your way. I appreciate it. Patrons are eligible for some exclusive discounts, Patreon giveaways, bonus content, and the Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. If you want to learn more and sign up, you can do so at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, we're about a week into November, which means it's still prime time in the grouse woods, unless you happen to hunt in Minnesota, where the rifle deer season will be starting this weekend, but maybe you're headed to the deer stand or headed to another state to chase birds. Either way, we've got some rough grouse conversation coming your way this week. We've got Cliff Enzer on the show, former guest, and known most notably for his work via Uplander, an upland hunting YouTube channel slash lifestyle gear and apparel centered around our favorite passion, chasing birds and bird dogs. I caught up with Cliff earlier this week, right in the heart of hunting season. We talked about some recent hunts, some of the things he gets asked about most often, and we shared some of the things that have been on our minds, again, as we continue to spend days in the grouse woods this fall. Before we bring Cliff on the show, I want to mention a promo code that Cliff made available for listeners of the Birdshot Podcast. You can use this code at uplanderlifestyle.com. Link to that in the show notes of the episode. Promo code is all one word, Birdshot15. That's capital B, capital S, Birdshot15. I'm not sure if the capital letters are required, but that's how Cliff sent it to me. I will include that code in the show notes as well, so there's no mistaking it. Birdshot15, you can save 15% site-wide at uplanderlifestyle.com. You've got hats, shirts, stickers, all kinds of good stuff. And you may recall, or if you're a new listener to the show, Cliff was actually the person that helped me come up with the artwork and sticker logos and stuff for the Birdshot Podcast. So if you like that, you will find plenty of stuff over at Cliff's website, uplanderlifestyle.com. All right. Hope you all are enjoying some November days afield. With that said, let's welcome into the conversation and back to the Birdshot Podcast, Cliff Enzer. All right, buddy. Are you more excited for deer camp or the last few days of the primetime first grouse season for you Michiganders?
I'm probably a little bit more excited for grouse hunting right now, just because I'm looking. I mean, this time of year always comes up, and it's kind of that time of year you really get excited as a grouse hunter, you know, when everything falls down and, you know, the birds have settled into, you know, the type of typical cover you're expecting them to be in and not so just broadcasted anywhere that they could possibly be. So you got a little bit maybe of a better idea of where you're going to go in and find some birds, hopefully, versus being spread out in that early season cover. And deer season coming up here in the next couple of weeks, it looks a little warm. Weather might be a little off-putting. But I did have some luck, and I was able to shoot a buck earlier with my bow back in end of October. So I got one under my belt already this year, got that out of the way. Unfortunately, I did leave the deer overnight, and the coyotes ate the whole dang thing. Unfortunately,
no way.
That was the bummer. Yeah, that was the bummer part about it.
Wow. I have heard of that happening. I feel like maybe from another one of my Michigan buddies. I mean, I know it's a problem in a lot of areas. I mean, how common is that?
I've experienced it. This is the third time. And
wow.
this was the worst time out of it all, because they ate the whole entire thing except for part of one front shoulder and the neck. But they ate the hindquarters on both sides, they ate the back straps and ribs off at each side. And pretty much all that was left was the cape and the neck. They completely tore off one front leg, and I flipped it over, and there was just a little bit of the shoulder left on one side and the neck going up to the head, and that was it. And that was the worst case that I've ever seen personally. It's happened a couple times where I've left a deer overnight and they just kind of nipped at the hind corners a little bit and everything was salvageable still. But yeah, this was the worst that I'd ever seen personally.
Gosh, I can't imagine that would be to have it happen multiple times, but that's obviously, you know, you're going to beat yourself up about that or be very disappointed. You know, that's not the way you want a hunt to come to a conclusion. What generally happened? I'm assuming archery hunting, you made a shot and you just had to make the call that you wanted to leave the deer and come back later. What kind of happened?
Yeah, so it was a half hour before sunset. The deer worked its way in and it came right through on a trail in front of me 20 yards. And I saw it was a single deer and a decent sized deer coming. And so I automatically just got ready and prepared for the shot because I was, you know, I'm mostly meat hunter. So I was looking for whatever I could get my hands on basically at that point, whether it was a doe or a buck, it didn't really matter to me. And it came in and I could see as soon as it got closer to me about 35 yards that it had antlers on top of its head. And where I hunt, it's a APR zone. So it has to have three points or more on one side. So you do have to count a little bit, but I could see it had, you know, three tines on each side coming up. So I was at that point, I was like, I don't need to count anymore. Yeah. I don't need to stare at this thing's rack anymore. I'm just going to get ready and focus on the shot. And the deer came in broadside at 20 yards. I stopped him, made the shot, and I felt really good about the shot. The deer took off and it looked like it was hit really well when it did. And I was hunting, I'm hunting on this line that's like some open timber that goes into some really younger scrubby oak. And the deer took off into that oak and I lost it probably 25, 30 yards after it took off and ran. So I couldn't see how far it went after that or any of the direction it went, but I had a good idea where it went. And I felt really good about the shot, that I made a clean, good shot. So I still gave it probably 20 minutes before I got down, and it was probably 10 minutes before legal shooting light when I got down. So it was starting to get dusk out, and especially in that thick oak cover, it gets really dark quick.
Yeah.
So I got down, I found the arrow immediately. It had good blood on it, found a little bit of blood at the point of impact. And then I followed another 10 yards in the trail that I thought it went, found a couple more spots of blood. And it was starting to get even darker at that point. And I just was not finding hardly any blood. And I did probably a 30 or 40 yard loop out in front of where I thought the deer went. And I thought I'd hear the deer crash actually, probably 3 minutes after I made the shot. I heard a crash. Yeah. So I felt like the deer was probably down somewhere. I wasn't 100% sure though. And just the amount of blood that I was finding, I was like, well, I'm just going to back out and, you know, go back and give the deer overnight because I didn't have any blood trails to follow on the deer. So that's how I made the decision. And I came back the next morning, picked up blood, and I still couldn't follow the blood trail all that well. It was really spotty from where I last found blood the night before. So I started wandering into the direction that I thought the deer had went, never found anything else. And I came back to the original spot where I found blood, got down on my hands and knees, and just started following pin drops of blood from there. And it took me another probably close to 45 minutes following this blood trail. And the deer only went 80 yards from where I shot it. And I finally found it, and it was just like a massacre site when I walked up to it finally. Man. But it was the really bummer part about it was that the shot was absolutely picture perfect because I flipped it over. It still had the shoulder on the opposite side intact and the hide right behind the shoulder intact. And the shot was like 2 inches right behind the shoulder, dead center in the body. And so, and that also, I do believe that crashing sound that I heard the night before, a couple minutes afterwards, was the deer expiring and falling over. It just, there was no way I was following that blood trail at night, even with a high powered light. I even struggled following it the next morning. I mean, going 80 yards following pin drops in full light, I still struggled to follow the blood trail.
Yeah.
So that was what was the really bummer part about the whole deal is it was a picture perfect shot. The deer, for whatever reason, just didn't bleed. And I've seen that a few times. Every once in a while, just for some reason, that you just don't get a blood trail. And I don't know why. I can't explain it other than you do enough stuff in the woods and you hunt enough, whether it's deer, big game, small game, you see some weird stuff from time to time. So it just, you know, doesn't make sense in your head and you can't explain it. And this was just one of those times.
Oh man. Yeah. What a, that is definitely a bummer. But like you said, when you hunt, it's not always pretty, and things like that, that you can't quite explain, do happen. Did you like second guess yourself, or like, you think you got to use a different broadhead or something next? I've never done any archery hunting. I kind of want to, but I need another passion or hobby. Like, I need a hole in my head. So I've steered clear.
No, I don't think it came down to the broadhead or this or that. I don't know. It's just one of those things I can't really explain, because I've shot various broadheads over the years, and I've had it happen a couple other times as well. I mean, whether it's fixed blade or mechanical, you just, and even people that I've helped track deer before, you know, they'll use like a 2.5-inch expandable broadhead, and for some reason you're just following pin drops of blood, and I don't know what it is. What if the hole gets plugged up for some reason on one side, and the deer just doesn't bleed out for whatever reason? But yeah, I don't think I'm changing any of my equipment because of it or anything.
Yeah. Well, so not much salvageable from that, it sounds like. So you're gonna have to get in the rifle stand here pretty soon.
Yeah, it's coming up November 15th, so I'm going up. I'm looking forward to that. It's the time of year I always get together with my dad. We go up to our cabin and spend a few days up there hunting together, and it's usually my one big hurrah with my dad hunting for the year, so I always look forward to that.
Yeah, that's cool. I remember we talked about that last time we had you on the show, and just the deer camp stuff, and it's every year it comes around. I was just hunting with a Michigan buddy of mine last weekend, and we're kind of talking about sort of the season ahead, and there's always that, you know, Michigan has the official shutdown of grouse season, November 15th through the end of the month, whereas we don't have that. And sometimes I wonder if that would just maybe put my mind at ease a little bit and just allow me to go deer hunting, because I always have a hard time going deer hunting now and leaving the bird dogs at home. But you guys don't have a choice.
Yeah. It's mandatory. I mean, it is like a light switch. As soon as I go out and start deer hunting that week, it's like automatic deer mode. And I just forget about grouse hunting, because you can't even do it. And, you know, even if it was, you know, you did have the option to still small game hunt during that time period, or grouse hunt during that period. It's just, I don't even think I would do it, just because that first week, especially going out, I mean, there's so many deer hunters here in Michigan, and it's even it's just a weird feeling walking out deer hunting, you know, thinking about how many people are out there with guns and just how many people you see walking around in the woods as well. It's just a kind of a weird feeling sometimes, just deer hunting itself. I can't even, you know, imagine thinking about being out there with a dog and how many people you'd run into. And, you know, people get weird sometimes about that kind of stuff, and they get a little upset, especially, I'm not trying to put a bad rap on deer hunters or anything, because I've had encounters that have, you know, swayed both sides of the fences, where they're like, oh no, you're fine, just, you know, keep on going, I'm gonna sit here, it's no big deal. And then you got other people that you run into that are all like, hey, I'm deer hunting here, what in the world are you doing right now? Like, why are you, no, what are you doing, why are you out here? And it's like, I had no idea you were sitting up here in this tree right now.
Yeah.
I think it, with rifle season, it'd be definitely a little bit more hairiers, because there's just so many more hunters than archery season.
Yep. I definitely agree. And I think that sentiment's pretty common among bird hunters. I'm actually in kind of an interesting spot where I live on the border of Minnesota and Wisconsin. So when Minnesota rifle season opens up this weekend, right when this podcast is releasing, I would agree. I would not go grouse hunting in the Minnesota woods. There's too many people out there. I'm fine. You know, it's opening deer camp. I don't need to be in the deer woods. The deer hunters can have it. I was a deer hunter, one of those people in the stand on opening day for a long, long time. If you have some piece of private land or something that you wanted to go hunt, you know, you could go do it, but I will start hunting Wisconsin, because their rifle season starts a little bit later. So to have that option, that has probably played the biggest part in me not doing a whole lot of deer hunting in the last handful of years.
Right, because you got the option just to skip right over and continue grouse hunting.
Exactly. So, and it's hard to stay out of the grouse woods when, you know, like a nice day in the deer stand kind of looks like a nice day in the grouse woods too. So the mental struggles this time of year.
Yeah, and it's funny whenever you have those nice days in the deer stand, you're sitting there in the afternoon going, gosh darn it, like I bet the birds are out this afternoon. You're sitting there, you're not seeing any deer, and you're like, man, be a good evening to be out grouse hunting. But then on some of those days you go out to grouse hunting and you're running into like fresh deer sign and heavy rubs and scrapes, and you're just going to an area that's all blown up and you're like, I wish I was sitting here deer hunting instead. I haven't seen a bird yet. I haven't moved a bird yet. Now I'm seeing all this deer sign. So it's kind of a funny little thing to go back and forth between.
Even though everything is pretty brown in the November woods, the grass still looks a little bit greener on the other side of the fence.
Yes, the grass is always greener. It's always greener. Even when you're grouse hunting, sometimes you second guess yourself going into a spot and you're like, I knew I should have went to this other spot tonight. Been in here 45 minutes now and haven't moved a bird. I bet they're loaded and packed at the other place I was thinking about hunting. And you don't know if that's the case or not, but yeah, the grass is always greener somewhere.
Exactly. Exactly. Do you have any, outside of the deer hunting that you've got coming up, do you have any other trips planned or hunts planned during that sort of, shutdown season in Michigan?
No, I don't. I've just been a homebody this year hunting at home in Michigan. For grouse, and that's been my season, and that's probably going to be my season throughout the rest of the year. I don't think I'm going anywhere or doing anything else this year.
Gotcha. You have a kiddo now?
No, I do not.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe I had seen or heard that at some point, but not yet.
Nope, no kid. Maybe I'll call my wife my kid this fall, because I've been staying home looking after her this fall, because at the end of summer she ended up breaking her foot. That kind of changed up all my plans for everything this fall. And that's why I've just been a little bit of a homebody this fall hunting grouse here in Michigan, and haven't been able to venture out or go anywhere out west or do anything or have any trips coming up that I have planned. So I've just been home with her.
You and the pups and mama.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Well, that's not the worst thing in the world. I know you love your grouse hunting, and you've got access to some good bird hunting. So how has the season been so far? I know from watching some of the videos, getting caught up a little bit. I haven't had as much time as I have previously to watch. I mean, there's lots of stuff, you know, you could spend all day watching grouse hunting videos now, which is kind of cool, but the storylines are pretty similar across the places that you and I are hunting. I feel like very, very mild temps up until pretty recently, very, very dry up until pretty recently. I mean, it kind of feels like we just hit mid-season form like not that long ago, and it is November already.
Yeah, that's definitely been the strange part about it. It's been a good season overall. I think the one thing that bums me out a little bit is I feel like this year had potential to be like a great year, like a really good year. Like there was opportunity for that, except if you flash back into like beginning June, mid-June, I know here in Michigan, we had a lot of heavy rains and some colder temps that came through. And as soon as that happened, I was already thinking, I was like, man, this probably isn't good for birds that are nesting right now. And I feel like that it kind of reflects on some of the numbers that I've seen this year. And it's been a good year. Like there's definitely birds around, but I feel like because of what happened throughout June, it really, you know, took what could have been a great year and brought it back down to a good year. So that's kind of the one thing that, you know, you can't control Mother Nature, but, you know, that's kind of the one thing that bums me out a little bit about this season. Not to say it hasn't been a really good year. It's been a lot of fun. There's definitely birds around to find, but man, I just keep thinking back to it. I'm like, if June would have gone just a little bit different, it would have just been an excellent year versus a good year.
Yeah. Oh, well, I pretty much would have the same thoughts going in my head. I mean, I'm out there and I'm reminding myself, like, we're grouse hunting. The weather is pretty nice recently. There are birds in the woods. We're lucky to be out here, but I feel the same way. We were affected by the recency bias. And I think, you know, last year seemed to be such a good hunting season. And for me, it was just what I'm noticing. Oh, there's a deer going by back there. Oh, that's a buck too.
Nice. For that, there you go.
That to happen. He's on the back ridge. I don't know.
You kind of see that time around of year. They're year.
Yeah. Anyways, the last year felt so consistent. It was like no matter where I hunted, no matter what I did, you were finding birds, and it was very consistent. And this year, I'm kind of curious, like, I don't know that this year is different than most any other year with it's less consistent from spot to spot. I'm finding birds and finding good numbers, but then I'll have hunts that are a lot more, like I was watching one of your videos where you said the woods are kind of lifeless in this part. Like it just didn't feel like there was a whole lot going on. And I think when you contrast that type of hunt to last year, at least from my experience, that's been the biggest thing I've noticed is just that inconsistency. And for all the reasons that you pointed out, that's what I'm thinking through as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that point right there. And that's exactly what it's been here this year as well. I mean, last year, if you look back on it, you could go into most spots and, you know, at least find a handful of birds to play with. And then you'd have some walks that were really, really good. But pretty much everywhere you were going, you were finding some birds to play with at least. And this year, some of the spots that normally produce birds that I've gone into in past years just have seemed lifeless. And there's just not much there, whether I've had a zero bird walk or just found one or two. But then you'll go into a spot after that and you'll find a pretty decent amount of birds. You'll have a pretty good walk. But yeah, just some of those spots that I was expecting to find some birds in this year, they just haven't been there. And I don't know if it's due to, you know, it could be a little bit due to the conditions that we've had this fall, but I really don't think so because they're kind of spots that should be holding birds regardless of what the weather and, you know, even with the drought conditions we've had this fall, there should be birds in there still.
Does Michigan, we were talking about this earlier in the season with drumming counts and sort of the winter survival. And we pretty much confirmed Minnesota, Wisconsin, the birds had very good winter survival because the drumming counts were significantly high. I know Michigan has changed up their strategy. Did they release anything? Like, was there any data points? I'm assuming you guys had the mild winter and everything that pretty much everybody had, just to kind of indicate that the winter survival was good. And then that led to obviously this spring that we have questions about.
No, I don't think they even do it anymore. Maybe they do and just don't release the information, but I think it was a handful of years ago they stopped doing it.
That sounds right to me. Yeah.
I think what it came down to is, and this could be hearsay, but I think what it was is there was a gentleman that was calling in and getting certain areas of where they were, you know, doing these counts at. And then he was backtracking and going and hunting. And it just came down to one individual, I think, that kind of spoiled the rest of it. And that's why they don't do it anymore. I can't confirm or deny that. That's just kind of,
I'm pretty sure you're right. I heard that too. It was people have leveraged the Freedom of Information Act in various ways to try to, sometimes in a nefarious way, other times in more, there's like some use cases or justifications for it, to get this information of wildlife tracking and biology. And, yeah, I know I heard that as well. So it could be true. Oh, he's bedded down back there now.
Oh, he's just chilling. Yeah. He's got a little sun down coming down. Yep.
There's a little ridge
for a little action.
Yeah, there's a little ridge behind the office here, and the bucks like to, that we haven't seen a whole lot of activity just yet, but as you know, now is the time. So we've started to see the bucks around during daylight. So when the video that you did that was not your most recent one, but the second one, looking for new areas, what to look for, what time was that, like early October?
Yeah, that was early October. I think that was actually the first week of October.
Okay.
I think it was October 2nd I started, went up and hunted for a stretch of 4 or 5 days. So yeah, it was that first week of October.
Yeah, that I was just watching and, you know, the woods were still pretty thick and I was kind of, the aspen were still pretty blotted out and you're kind of commenting on that. And that feels like a long time ago. Now the woods have opened up pretty good, but that was still some pretty thick early season cover and just getting glimpses of the birds basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's rough grouse hunting in a nutshell, right? You just, you know, sometimes you just get a glimpse of a bird, or you don't even see it, you just hear it take off. And that's pretty common in that early season part of the year. But one thing I tried to focus at, and I've been trying to pick at this method a little bit more over the last few years, is not getting wrapped up in that thick stuff, especially for that early season part of the year, and just finding more open areas, like especially clearings that are around. You know, you don't have to necessarily be hunting aspen all the time, but if you can find an area that has aspen in it, and you can try and find some more open areas that maybe have a little bit of a brushy line to them, and there's a little bit of food mixed in the area, those are the kind of areas I've been trying to focus more on that early season part of the year. Maybe it's a little bit older aspen that's, you know, within a half mile or a mile radius of, you know, a prime age cut. And instead of working around that prime age cut that's really thick and a tangled mess to get through that time of year, where you'll probably find some birds in it, there'll be some birds hanging out in there for sure. But your shooting opportunities are probably usually pretty limited. So I've been trying to, you know, pick at this method of the last couple of years of working these clearing type areas around some of those prime age aspen stands. And I feel like it's taken me probably 4 years to get the method of it down. But I feel like now I'm pretty confident in going into some of these areas and going, there's going to be grouse here. And you might not get the numbers that you're always expecting. It might just be a handful of birds, but you're going to get some better shooting opportunities. And that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. There's something to be said about going to a place that you want to be, you want to hunt the birds, you want to go for a walk, you want the dogs to run through. And yeah, it doesn't have to be face swatting broomstick aspen. You can hunt around that stuff. And the dogs might pull you in there, but you can go around it as well. I would say I have done a lot of that myself. And I think the other factor, which I think you would probably think the same thing, is that you know what the 10-year-old aspen stand is. You know there are birds in it and moving through it. But I feel like I have an opportunity to learn more by hunting around that, because the aspen stand, maybe that gives you the confidence you need to know that there's birds in the area. And then you hunt the other stuff and you look for identifying the diversity, the edges, the openings, all of that stuff. And you slowly build your confidence as you move birds in that other stuff outside of the little aspen stand.
Yes, that's exactly it to a T. You can find a prime age cut, and instead of just saying, I'm going to dive right in and, you know, hunt around the edge of this cut, there's probably other birds that are in the area, and they might not necessarily be in the aspen because they don't live in that aspen stand 100% of their life from a day-to-day basis. They just, you know, will casually use it when needed. But they do use quite a bit of the area in surrounding areas, and you can go in and you can make anything. And I think you can take those areas around those aspen cuts and you can make an edge out of anything that you want to, whether it's a shadow line, whether it's, you know, maybe a spot where a light forest, a little bit of more of an open forest meets more of a darker side of a forest, and you can work that turns into an edge and you can work that down. Or maybe you find a little bit more of a brush line that's within, you know, an older forest around an outside edge of a prime age cut. And you can work those types of edges and find birds in there and usually get better shooting opportunities.
Yeah. I have heard you talk about kind of light and shadows before, and I pay attention to it, but it's not like part of my little inner dialogue too often. How do you like dig a little deeper on that? How do you think about light and shadows, and specifically like as an edge? Because I haven't thought about that a lot.
It's not something that I necessarily go into a spot looking for, but as you're working through an area, you can kind of just look at what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. And if you see something like that, where, you know, maybe there's a little bit more of an opening here in the forest, and then it gets just a little bit thicker with some more canopy that's right next to it, and those two kind of run right next to each other, it creates kind of an edge right there where there's a shadow on one side, and one side's real dark, and then the other side is really open and light. And I do have good success finding birds right along those edges. And it's not something I go into a spot, you know, thinking I'm going to go and find this and look. It's just, you kind of just run into it as you're working through a spot, and then eventually I kind of see it and I'll start migrating and moving towards it. And yeah, there's sometimes birds sitting on that type of edge.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. There's, it's, you're not looking at a map looking for a tall stand of trees that you think is going to cast a shadow. There are things you look for on the map, but then there are things you look for as you're moving through the cover. And so light and shadows would be one of those things. And I would certainly agree. I've flushed enough grouse from under a little balsam tree or out of a shadow. I mean, they certainly know how to use their environment to conceal themselves and escape.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. It's all in real time and what's in front of you and being able to adapt while you're walking, you know, instead of just having a set, you know, map in your head of saying, this is looking at an area and say, this is the line that I'm going to walk throughout the cover, which, you know, I generally do. I have a good idea of where, kind of how I'm going to work through an area, but you know, that all changes as you're going through it. And mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I get drawn off that, you know, map that's in my head, you know, either following the dog because he's going somewhere else and starting to work birds or getting birdie, or if I'm just going through and I'm looking at something else now that I'm seeing in real time. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to kind of work over to that instead. And maybe eventually I'll make my way back to this line that I'm working now, but I'm going to go see what this is over here and if it can produce anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely grouse hunting right there. You know, you might have the plan, at the tailgate, but getting in the cover, it's all about observation, following the dogs and making those decisions and, you know, just going for a walk through the woods and being confident that you chose the right area to begin with. And now you're just exploring and trying to figure out what that area has going on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, grouse hunting as well too. You don't always know where the birds are going to be. A lot of times you can think in your head, well, I'm going to go in and work this, and this is where the birds should be. But, you know, sometimes that's the case and a lot of times it's not the case, but they can be anywhere. So, you know, they'll throw you for a loop sometimes and you'd be like, how in the heck did I find, you know, a bird in this when I was, you know, planning on working this over here and I just randomly walked into this and it just makes no sense at that time. So there is a little bit of that to it too, as well. Just some randomization where, you know, you're going to work something and sure as heck, yeah, there's a bird sitting there for some reason where you don't expect it to be.
Did you, with the dry conditions and the mild weather kind of early season, did anything jump out at you like, oh, the birds are using this stuff because of these conditions? And I'll just say, that was kind of in the back of my mind the whole first month and a half of the season, because it was so dry and so warm. I was like, I just don't know. I couldn't tell if it was just inconsistent bird numbers or if there was something we were missing because of the extreme. And I'll use the word extreme because it was, I mean, there was mid-October. It was like, I mean, bone dry and really warm. But I will say now it's November 6th today. I never really came to a conclusion like, yeah, the birds were here early season. The only thing I could say about my season thus far is that it's just a lot less consistent than the previous few years have been.
Yeah, really inconsistent. And I don't know if I can draw an exact map to why some of the birds were where they were for that reason, but I think I can say as to why they weren't into some of the spots, especially, you know, some of the spots that, you know, are more aspen heavy that, you know, I was expecting to find some birds in earlier in the year. Those cuts just got so dried up and mm-hmm. they just had no understory to them at all. It was all burnt to a crisp and the aspen just looked in rough shape. And I think that's why the birds weren't there, because there was just no understory there for them at that time of year. And so they got pushed into, you know, some other surrounding brushy areas or something like that. And also a thing that's this year as well that I noticed is all the soft mass crops. And I don't know what it looks like in your area, but it's been kind of hit or miss this year. There hasn't been, I would even say it's worse than hit or miss. And there's just been a few areas that I've gone into where there's some hawthorn that has a little bit of fruit on it. And then a lot of it that I'm finding didn't have anything on it. But some of those spots where I did have some success was some of the areas that I found a little bit of that soft mass fruit. And so that was a little bit what I tried to key in earlier in the season, because I figured, well, it's not as spread out as it has been in years past. There isn't as much of it. It's not as abundant. So if I found a spot, like there was a couple times where I drove into the trails and I found a hawthorn tree that was just loaded. And I was like, I haven't seen a whole lot of that this year. I'm going to turn around the truck and I'm going to park here and I'm going to work down this trail. And sure as heck, you know, right out the bat, we were running into birds as soon as we got that past some of those hawthorn trees. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So it's not, I know there where I was hunting, a lot of the spots didn't have the soft mast crops, but if I found a spot where there was some, yeah, I was hunting there because I know that's going to like, it's not as the food isn't as spread out this year. It's going to hopefully conjugate some birds into this specific spot instead of them just being so spread out, finding soft mast crops wherever.
Yeah, pretty similar. The areas that I tend to hunt, they don't have as much of the, certainly not as much hawthorn as I imagine you find in some of the areas that you hunt, and other soft mast. I mean, the vast majority of crops that I have cleaned this year, I mean, there's maybe a berry here or there, but it's basically all greens and now hazel catkins. You know, it's heavy, heavy greens early. They are definitely transitioning into the hazel catkins now. I cleaned a bird earlier this week that, you know, it was a good tennis ball sized crop full of hazel catkins. So our birds, because we have so much hazel brush, are in that stuff pretty heavy right now, which we've talked about it many times on the show before. It's not something that it's something I look for, but it's so common and so prevalent. It isn't something that when you find it, you are automatically going to find grouse because we pretty much have hazel brush everywhere throughout most of our covers.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. It makes it tough to pin down and just say, I'm going to go through here and, you know, hopefully find birds in here because sometimes it's the case and they're there. They happen to be there and you get lucky. But a lot of times with food sources like that, that are so abundant and spread out, it's hard to pin down, you know, finding birds in a specific food cover like that, just because it's so available everywhere.
Yeah. And I've got some areas that I hunt that do have some hawthorn. I haven't spent really a little bit of time. I hunted one or two covers and didn't get into the hawthorn. So I don't really know how it did in the areas that I tend to hunt, but I imagine it's similar and inconsistent. And I'll probably be spending some more time in those areas in the next couple of weeks. So we'll see what we find, but yeah, you make a good point. The aspen stands tend to lose their leaves early. And with that heat and that sunlight in early October, they really, really dried out. I mean, they were crispy and crunchy.
Yeah. I mean, some of the raspberry leaves and bushes that you usually expect, you won't find berries on them, you know, by the end of September, early October, but a lot of them still have their leaves on them and they'll eat those green leaves as long as they stay green. But this year, I mean, they were all burnt up pretty fast. And just everything that was in that aspen that usually have a nice understory to go with the aspen was all just burnt up and gone.
Yeah. I see a lot of raspberry when I watch your videos. I see a lot of raspberry in some of those covers. It's you tend to hunt those areas. We have a lot of it here. I would say that's a good, if listeners don't know, like if they don't identify raspberry, it's one to pay attention to. You see them a lot in young aspen cuts. They tend to grow in the old log landings, the open areas. If you see a slash pile, it'll have raspberry around it. And just like Cliff said, you're not going to find raspberries. Usually during most of the hunting season, you won't see any raspberries, but the birds have kind of been in and around those raspberry patches for a good chunk of the year, probably eating bugs and insects and other green leaves. And then they will continue to eat those raspberry leaves as long as they're around. So that's a plant that I'm always looking for. And the other way I find it is you'll find the stems in the ears of my setters. I don't know if you get them on your Brittany's, but that's
yeah,
all I know.
Yeah,
the
I definitely do. And I think that maybe I'm not necessarily going into a spot looking to hunt those, but I feel like the areas that I hunt, it's a good gauge on whether that cut is going to hold birds or not. And it's from the aspect, I think, is it's usually when I find those raspberries, it's usually means the soil has a little bit more moisture to it. And there's a lot more that's growing in that cut besides just aspen. And if it's, you know, if you don't have those raspberries, it usually seems like the cut doesn't have a lot of other stuff coming up with it as well. And you don't have as much of an understory to it. But if you find some of those cuts that have raspberries in it, then it usually has a lot more growing up in it besides just aspen. And those are typically the spots that I have better luck at finding more birds in them than just, you know, places that are a little bit more barren and don't have a lot to them besides just aspen.
Yeah. Yeah. That was something I picked up. I appreciate, like, you know, some of the videos that I was watching. I like how you're kind of teeing up the hunt and you're going over the high level. So I imagine you get lots of questions about this sort of stuff as I do. You're going over the high level area of, okay, there's a 12-year-old aspen cut here. There's a couple creeks and drainages and commenting about the soil type. And then you mentioned you're really looking for diversity, and diversity kind of like, it's like one of those words like edges where it gets thrown around and thrown around and thrown around. It's like, what do you mean by diversity? And it seems like you've been trying to dive into that and explain it a little bit. Talk about some of those things. What are the things that make you feel like an area has diversity?
I think just from a broad like overview, like it doesn't matter if it's rough grouse, prairie birds, or whatever I'm hunting. And people are always asking, like, how do you scout? Like, what are you looking for? And I don't think it's one aspect or thing that I'm looking for. It's all about diversity in a spot, and it's not being one dimensional. It's having, you know, different things mixed into a spot that besides just one aspect, whether it's, you know, let's just say rough grouse hunting, besides just aspen being there, like what else can you find? Funny though, I will get into this after this, because tonight I'm planning on going up tonight and I'm going to hunt a spot that is just aspen, and I'll explain that spot in a little bit. But perfect. Before we get to that, diversity is, yeah, that's just kind of like what I look for in everything when I'm hunting. And I think it's just a multiple different, you know, habitats that are within a block of an area that you're going to look to hunt. And you can say, hey, there's aspen here. There's a creek that runs over here. There's a red pine stand over here. There's white pines over here. And this all doesn't have to be within like a several hundred yard radius. Like this could be a mile, even a 2 mile block of an area where at least you can say within this big chunk of area, there's a few different things that's mixed into this, you know, habitat. It's not just one habitat type. There's multiple different things here. And within those different things, you're going to get all kinds of different edges. You're going to get a lot of different stuff that grows up in a lot of different areas and covers for birds to be in. And so even if it's a really dry year or, you know, there's been hunting pressure in the area, there's all kinds of different areas for the birds to be in besides just one line of trying to hunt. And you can kind of pick apart these places and go through it and try and hunt all these different edges and all these different habitat types within a block besides just getting so focused on, you know, one line or one specific thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Taking that step back and again, knowing that you don't have to walk through every piece of it, but there's the high level diversity. And then kind of like we talked about a few minutes ago, then when you got boots on the ground and you're moving through the cover, then you kind of take on a little bit more of a micro lens and you're looking for those small little edges, those small pieces of diversity where the alder patch comes in and you have a little opening here and the grass is there and there's one spruce tree or a red pine tree over there, you know, that's sort of micro diversity.
Yes, exactly. Yep. That's exactly what it is.
And then the grouse shoots across the opening and you miss, although you've been knocking some birds down. You had a couple of those tree birds and a couple wide open birds that you've been shooting pretty well.
Yeah. I got a little bit lucky on some of those birds. I mean, a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while. And, you know, it just comes down to you spend enough time, you know, doing something. Eventually you're going to run into those types of opportunities. It's not, you know, every single time you go out, but, you know, you spend enough time doing something, you sometimes get lucky and you find birds like that for whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Tell me about I'm thinking I'm going to be hitting the grouse woods this afternoon as well. So that's good news for both of us. But tell me about the big aspen stand that you're thinking about this evening.
So a spot that I really like to hunt. It's one of my better spots. And I guess I won't say my spot. It's not my spot, but just one of the spots I enjoy hunting, especially this time of year. It's completely opposite of everything we were just talking about. And it's just one big giant aspen stand. I think it's probably close to 160 acres. It's just one big giant continuous cut. And for whatever reason, and I'm assuming it's just because of the aspen, it holds a lot of birds, and there's literally no diversity around this thing. It's just one big giant continuous cut that's in the middle of the woods. And on one side of it, there's a lowland area bog, and it's not even like a moisture area of that that's holds standing water or anything like that. It's real dry, and it's just this vast, wide open area. Like if you think of like if you went moose hunting or something like that, and I'm not the best when it comes to be able to identifying plants and things like that. I just know like what grouse habitat looks like. Yeah. I don't know necessarily what everything's called. So I don't know how to identify this or call it by its right name, but it's just this big wide open area of nothing that runs along next to this aspen cut. And then on the other side, all three sides of it, it's just old timber and it's old aspen. Yeah. It's all grown up around it. It's a really old, mature forest. But outside of that, like there's no other diversity to this spot or anything. There's no creek or different pine stands or anything that run around it. It's just like 150, 160 acres of continuous aspen, but it holds birds and the birds are there. And I think they're only there because like there's nowhere else for them to be in that area. So kind of exact opposite of what we were just talking about of trying to find diversity and where birds can be and, you know, in different spots. And for whatever reason in this spot, they're just there because it's the only option and choice they have to be.
Yeah. On the 160, like the major aspen stand, what kind of age is it? Or, and maybe, you know, age varies from region to region, but like, is it a young stand kind of right in the sweet spot of a stand, or is it starting to get a little bit taller, a little bit thinner?
Yeah, it's like a prime age cut. It's 13 okay. years old now. I think it is. I think it was a 2011, and I've been hunting there for 5 years now. So it was, you know, 8 years old or something like that when I first started hunting it, and it's grown up considerably since that now. And it's starting to look, you know, like it's almost into pole timber in some spots, but you know, the birds are still there. And just because it's getting a little bit older in some of those spots doesn't mean that the birds are transitioning out of it necessarily. But yeah, that's all it is. It's just one big swath of aspen. And I feel like the birds are just there because there's nowhere else for them to be in that area. Cause it's all just mature, wide open forest around it. There's just nothing else besides the aspen.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Again, kind of for some of the reasons you mentioned, when it's earlier season, thicker, hotter, I tend to look for those edges, older stands, just stuff that has good shrub underlayer. Maybe there's a young aspen cut nearby, but I'm trying not to be in there if I don't have to be. So I've been hunting a lot of that because of the conditions thus far. But then I just had a kind of a long weekend at grouse camp, and we were trying some stuff. Trying to hunt some of the 14, 15, 16 year old aspen. And we were finding birds, but nothing that said, hey, we got to keep hunting this. So, for the evening hunt, I was looking at the map and had never been there before. My buddy Jay and I, we had an hour and a half to go. And I just found an area that had, it was all the same timber harvest, I'm assuming, 10 year old aspen on the map. But it was like a chunk here, chunk there. It was chunked out really nicely. So in the middle of all those chunks, you've got mature timber, seams and edges. And we went in there, and as soon as we stepped into the 10-year-old aspen, like right on the edge of it, right where a grouse should be, there was a mature seam, and he was right on the edge of that aspen. We flushed a grouse. And then we just kind of dove into the 10-year-old aspen because there was a trail there, and you could see all of the raspberry. This cut in particular had a lot of raspberry remnant stems and bushes and stuff, not a lot of green left in there, but you could tell the raspberry was there. And we just started popping up birds kind of left and right in there in the 10-year-old aspen. So that, it kind of got me thinking, like, I don't know, maybe there was just a little bit of a, you know, birds tend to move through that stuff and shuffle through it during the shuffle season, which typically happens in October. but it just sort of got me thinking, maybe the things are a little bit behind and they're just kind of using that stuff right now. And so for my hunt this evening, I kind of was looking at my son and I were actually looking at maps last night, and we're looking at some 8, 9, 10 year old aspen, which again, this time of year, it's not as bad to hunt because all the leaves are off and the grass and some of the stuff, you know, I don't like to be in that stuff. If it's too grassy, that's starting to lay down a little bit. We haven't had a whole lot of frost or snow or anything to knock it down, but I might find myself in a spot like that this afternoon as well.
Yeah, I think that's like for the rest of my grouse hunting here, like that's probably what I'm going to be looking to hunt over the next few days is more of those, you know, aspen driven spots, aspen edges, things like that, because all the stuff, like you mentioned, is starting to come down. The woods are a little bit more bare. So I feel like this time of year, you know, early in the year, the birds are really spread out. They can be anywhere. They're starting to transition to where they want to be for the fall, but they're still, you know, there might be a pocket of something over here that they're in, another pocket over here they could be in. And well, now all that stuff is dead and it's down and the woods look a lot different. So like probably what I'm going to be looking for over the next week is just like finding high stem density areas, you know, that has a little bit more cover to it than, you know, some of the open, more hardwoods areas that I was hunting earlier in the year, you know, that had a little bit more cover underneath to them, older aspen stands that I was hunting. And you mentioned it once, you know, those older aspen stands have early in the year have a lot of cover in them growing up still. So even though they're older, they have a lot of, you know, cover that's growing up underneath them because a little bit more of the sunlight starting to get down to some of those spots as well. And it's producing some things that are, excuse me, growing up underneath them. But now all that stuff is kind of disappearing pretty quickly. And I feel like this is the time of year I start hunting aspen edges a little bit more and hunting trails that go through aspen and just looking for, you know, higher stem density areas, places that, you know, are thicker cover, instead of hunting those broad areas just through some open hardwoods, trying to find some shrubby lines or some different stuff that's growing up in an understory.
Yeah. Yep. That's a good point. And to sort of dovetail on that, I don't know what, if it's a timing thing or if it's a weather temperature condition thing, but what exactly triggers the grouse to start moving to its winter habitat where you're looking for, you know, Andy Andrew and I always talked about, you know, they're trying to find as much diversity in as small of a piece of cover as they can find. So you've got, you know, the cedar swamp or the spruce swamp and then some hazel brush, that kind of stuff. It doesn't feel like they're desperately seeking that stuff out yet. They're still moving through some of the big aspen cuts and moving through that high stem density stuff. Now that the grass and the weeds and some of the other shrub underlayers are starting to thin out, they've got to look for that protection and cover through that woody vegetation and the stem density. So yeah, I think you're on the right track as far as what to look for this time of year and anybody else.
Yeah. And also just to hit on, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, the grouse starting to move into smaller spots and, you know, just the way the weather's been this year, like they haven't been forced to have that mindset yet where, you know, hey, it's getting cold. We've had a little bit of snow that's came down. We've had some really frosty mornings. So like, I don't think the birds are to that point yet in their cycle where they're thinking like, hey, I need to start conserving, you know, I can't be moving around as much. I need to start conserving my energy and gearing up for winter. You know, it's been pretty lax this year. It's been really mild weather. So in their heads, they're just thinking, I've got time, all the time in the world yet to do what I want. I don't have to try and sit in one spot and conserve all my energy for, you know, cold days coming up.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. How about oaks? How do oaks factor into what you're looking for or analyzing cover? Do you, I know you guys have a lot of scrub oak and stuff. Do you hunt bigger oak stands along the edges of them or, and then,
Especially this year, or this time of year right now, because that's another thing, like, because all the other leaf cover is falling down, all your understory, everything is dying, your grass, your ferns, so, you know, all the lush stuff that you had before is all dying and everything just looks really barren. But yeah, those oak trees and that scrub oak will still hold their leaves for so long. That's like another canopy over top that I feel like birds really do key in on this time of year because everything else is gone. So that is another thing that, you know, I'll throw in the mix and try and target. And if I can find a nice spot to go in and hunt this time of year, absolutely, because that's one of the last things left, you know, with leaves on it. And another one that goes along with that is beech. I really like hunting spots that have a lot of beech in it this time of year, because those beechwood trees, just like oak, will still hold their leaves for so long. When everything else is dead and dying, I'll go into spots that have a lot of beech in it and have really good success as well, because those have a lot of cover on them as well to this time of year.
Yeah, that's cool. Whenever somebody talks about beech trees, I always think of the, I don't know if you ever read the Irish Red. There are these Jim Carlsgaard books about red setters, and they're based in, I don't know if they ever say it, but I think it's supposed to be in New England, an area that has a lot of beech trees, and they write about grouse hunting with bird dogs, and they talk about beech trees. But I don't hunt a lot of beech because I don't think we have a lot, but I know that's a preferred food source where it does grow.
Yeah, we have a lot of beech here, and it grows up in a lot of aspen cuts as well. So like even in some of these aspen cuts, you'll have, you know, beech that's the same age as the aspen that's growing up. Okay. And I don't typically always venture in and actually hunt the cuts themselves, like deep inside of a cut. But there is some spots like this time of year where you'll have, you know, that sections of beech that's growing up with that aspen inside the cuts. And every once in a while, I'll veer off my path, you know, around the, if I'm hunting an edge or something, and I'll actually go into the aspen if I see, you know, some of these pockets of beech that's growing up in the aspen, and go in there and try and hunt that, because that turns into its own little edge itself within the aspen cut, where that beech still is holding all of its leaves, and it still has a really nice canopy over top of it, and a lot of, you know, it gives a lot of cover from overhead. And I do have good luck finding birds along those types of edges within aspen cuts that still has beech growing up in it.
Are there any other things that you look for as like an understory, like a shrub underlayer? I know you don't typically have the amount of hazelbrush that we would hunt here, but what else do you, or if you find like, say, a mature aspen stand, do you have some of those mature aspen stands that have a real good shrub underlayer? And if so, do you know what it is or like what you're looking for?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you what I'm looking for off the top of my head. Like I mentioned, like I am just like not the guy to talk about, you know, different plants and biology and things like this. I just know what it looks like in my head. Like I can pick it out and know what it looks like in my head, but I couldn't specifically sit here and say, this is X and this is Y and this is Z. It's probably something I need to, you know, learn a little bit more about, but I just know what it looks like. And that's all I've gone off of for my grouse hunting career, is just knowing what it looks like versus knowing what it's actually called. But yeah, if you can find, you know, especially this time of year when everything else dies, anything that has any stemmy texture or stemmy cover to it, you know, that's what I'm looking for. Anything that has a brushy or stemmy cover to it. Besides just aspen as well, you know, a lot of times that's where those birds are starting to flood into and seek a little bit more cover versus just being so spread out, wherever they could, where you might find them earlier in the year.
Yeah. I agree. It's one of those things that, you know, I'm getting better and better. I've gotten curious about it, and I've tried to learn some of the stuff, but for a long time, the only thing I would say in my head is that looks grousey, you know, and it doesn't really need to be any more complicated than that. If you know you're in an area that has rough growth, then it's kind of, it goes back to this stem density, and people, you know, you spend enough time doing it, you know, if you're looking at birdie cover, you know, is there a deadfall here? There's a patch of shrubs over here. You don't exactly have to know what it is to know that it's grouse cover, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. Anywhere you can see that's got a little bit more brush to it or some more stem density to it, you can say, yeah, there's probably going to be some birds sitting around in this area here, especially if you have everything that goes along with it as well. I mean, if you're just driving down, you know, an old logging road through an old forest, you'll see some of those, you know, same things that you'll, let me back up, I guess, a little bit. So you have those types of high stem density areas and different brushy under areas that you'll find some birds in, but you'll find that type of cover anywhere. Mm-hmm. Whether you're driving through an older forest or, you know, an area that has cuts in it. And every once in a while, I think you'll find some birds or a bird or two. If you're in like an old area, there might be a grouse or two that's hanging out around in there, but I'll just skip through that area and won't even, you know, hunt it. And unless there's, you know, other things around in that area that has new growth or cuts in the area to go along with it. So you'll find that kind of undergrowth everywhere, but I don't really target it unless I know there's specific aspen in that general area. Cause you'll find that stuff everywhere. It's pretty much everywhere. It's pretty common, even in really old areas, but you've got to have, you know, the younger aspen to complement it as well.
Right. Right. Yeah. When you are fortunate to hunt areas that have lots of public land and you have in a timber industry and cutting and the kind of habitat that we're looking for, then you're not limited to hunting only a certain spot. You're trying to go to areas that have bird densities and lots of huntable cover. So that's a kind of a natural filtering or selection process. Makes sense.
Yeah. Yep.
You remember the bird that you flushed a group of grouse when Yeti went down to lay down in a mud puddle?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was like, that was almost kind of like the knife going through our heart right there. Like that was the dagger in the hunt, because it had been such a long walk that morning. And I typically don't do walks that long and that big. It was like 8.5 miles that I walked that morning. And I usually do half of that. You know, it was like a 4.5 hour walk we did, and I did just over 8 miles. And I usually typically do 1.5 to 2 hours on a walk for a spot. Yeah. Like that's a pretty good size walk on the bigger end. But like that morning we kept going farther back into cover and farther back, and there was more cover back in the area that I was hunting, and I was like, well, I'm just gonna keep going back and exploring. And we went back there and found a few birds, but nothing that was like to write home about. And then came back to the trail I was originally on and started making our way back to the truck. And we still had over halfway to go back to the truck. And I was pretty tired at that point. And the dog had just came across a big mud puddle and he just laid down in it. And I just was like, all right, that's cool. Like, you want to cool off a little bit. It's been a long walk. And I was just standing there watching him just lick up a bunch of water and laying in this mud puddle. And then out of nowhere, three grouse just flushed in this open forest right next to me off the trail edge. I grabbed him up out of the mud puddle and was like, well, let's just go see if there's, you know, one dumb one that's still sitting in here over on this little edge that's off the edge of this open forest. And yeah, we went in there another 40 yards and he went on point. I walked in, bird was damn near got up at my feet. Just one of those, you know, just one of those shots that you dream about as a grouse hunter and you typically don't ever get. And I just about stepped on the bird when it finally got up.
Yeah. The thing that I found interesting about that, and that's one of the things that I appreciate when I do run the GoPro myself, and you kind of watch the slow motion stuff, like you can really, you know, you can really see like something like that. I mean, it happens in an instant. Bird's at your feet, he's up, bang bang, he's down. But when you watch it in slow motion, your first shot was really quick, which is probably about the exact same time that I would have shot. Like, no matter how close the bird is, like, it's almost like the closer it is, the faster I go through the motions, which is like the opposite of what you should be doing. Like, you could just let the bird get out there a little ways. But your first shot you missed because you're mounting the gun, and you can the gun movements are so accentuated by the slow motion. But then your second shot, you hit the bird, and I think, like, in my mind, if you were doing the bang bang dang, like, is so common, you know, when you shoot twice and then you have all day to shoot the bird, like you shot twice too quickly, you kind of like it almost like you caught yourself, because that second throwaway shot would have been right into a tree, basically. Like, the bird goes right behind a tree, and it's kind of like when my brain was saying, this is probably when I would have shot again, you didn't. And the bird emerges on the other side of the tree, and then you dropped it, which this kind of a goofy little slow motion thing, but it was interesting to watch as you know, somebody I've seen that a lot, and I probably shot twice too quickly a lot in those situations.
Yeah, that's like one of the hardest parts about those shots sometimes, especially the really open ones that you get, is because most of your shots you're catching a glimpse of the bird and you're just pulling up A lot of times you're not even getting your head down fully. You're just like instinctively shooting in the direction where you think that bird is going to end up. And sometimes your shot connects and sometimes you miss, but it's just a really quick snapshot, one or two shots that you get off. But every once in a while you'll get those open shots and they always throw me off just because I'm so used to just pulling up and going bang real quick. And, you know, this was one of those cases where the bird got up and I had, you know, a really good look at it. And also a lot of times in these situations where I have a really good look at the bird, I'll notice like my eyes will just stay on the bird and I don't always fully get my head down on the gun because I'll see the bird take off from the ground and my eyes just stay completely focused on that bird. And I never really get like my line of sight down the barrel correct because my eyes are just staying on that bird the whole entire time. So a lot of times I miss that first shot just because my eyes are so focused on staying on the bird because it's what I've been looking at the whole entire time for that split second. But then after you miss and like I saw kind of the direction where that bird was heading, I was like, all right, this bird is still right here. Like I got a second to line this up. And I'm going to try and make the second shot count because I only got one more shot left. So I've got to make the second one count. And this bird flushed at my feet. There's no way I can just let this get away. I've got to make the second one. So I just kind of took a little bit of a, you know, a deep breath and relaxed a little bit and just made sure to line up the second shot. And he crossed across that tree and I was like, there it is. And I just got out in front and pulled the trigger. And I do that a lot. I notice when I go pheasant hunting, you know, especially after I've been grouse hunting all year, if I go pheasant hunting, like I constantly am doing that because I'm just so used to the bird getting up and you have a split second to look at it. And I'm just trying to shoot in the direction that the bird is going. You know, when I go pheasant hunting now, the bird gets up and you have, you don't have all day, but sometimes it feels like, you know, you have a minute to watch that bird get up and be able to settle into your shot, get the swing on it. But grouse hunting is far from that. So you're always just pulling up and shooting real quick. And a lot of times when I go pheasant hunting for the first time after grouse hunting quite a bit, I always do that. And I always miss the first shot just because I just pull up and shoot, bang. And like, that's it. Like I'm not even trying to get my head lined up and get into my swing nicely on the gun. I just pull up and go bang. And it's like, all right, I got to settle down a little bit for the second shot and trying to get into my swing here because I got plenty of time. So I do that a lot when I go pheasant hunting too. I just pull up and, you know, just shoot the gun on the first shot.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm sure there's a lot of grouse hunters kind of smiling and nodding their heads to that as I am. That's very common. I think that's probably why I've heard it from time to time. Never tried it myself, although I could see in theory the value of it. People talk about like just putting one shell in the gun to like really make you think about like when you're going to take that shot and maybe hit the brace. Cause I do that a lot too. You have to shoot fast to a certain extent, but you usually have more time than you think, to make those.
Yeah, you definitely do. And that's something I've kind of forgot about this a little bit this year. And it's something I've always told myself in the past and kind of like what I made my foundation of shooting at grouse around is like, you have more time than you think. And somewhere along the line I haven't even really thought about that this year that much until you actually just brought that up. But that's a very good point. You do have more time than you realize to shoot, especially on some of these birds when you see it get up. And it's even if it's going through cover, you know, you have a split second more than you really think you do to get lined up right properly on the bird and make the shot count instead of just pulling up and pulling the trigger.
Yep.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring this up and mention to you and see what you do, because this is one thing that I've been thinking to myself quite a bit this year. And I don't know when this happened or why this happened. But I've always been somebody that shoots with I'm right eye dominant. So I use my right eye, and I grew up, shooting trap and skeet from a very young age. And I always would close my non-dominant left eye and I would get lined up, and that transitioned over into my whole career of wing shooting as well. I know for a fact I always closed my left eye and would just use my right eye looking down the barrel. And I don't know when it switched or why it happened, but this year I've noticed that like I'm not closing my left eye. I have both eyes open and I'm not even necessarily like looking directly down the barrel. I feel like I'm just more shooting instinctively than I have before in the past. And I keep thinking about it every time I shoot a shot, I kind of like flash back into it. I'm like, I had both of my eyes open there and I don't know why I'm doing that now or how it's transitioned into that, but I've just started shooting with both my eyes open. And I feel like I've been connecting on a fair amount of my shots this year. And I feel, you know, pretty good about some of the shots that I've taken, but yeah, I've been shooting with both eyes open. And I feel like I'm just shooting a little bit more instinctively this year than just how I've done it in the past, where I'll close one eye and try and get lined up, looking straight down the barrel at the bead and the bird. And then for some reason this year, I'm doing completely opposite of that. I feel like both my eyes are open and I'm just getting my head down on the gun and I'm finding a little bit of the end of the barrel and the bird with both eyes. And I'm just pulling the trigger and squeezing it off where I think the bird's going to be. Yeah. And it's been working for me, so I'm not going to complain about it, but I just don't know where along the lines I somehow made that switch or why I made that switch.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like you've probably just been listening to a lot of birdshot podcasts. No, honestly, it sounds like you've kicked a bad habit. You know, the closing the off eye is a technique that some people utilize and need to utilize if they have a little bit less of a strong, say, right eye dominant or dominant eye. Sometimes squinting to close that off eye and get your vision over the barrels and onto the target is what some people need to do. You maybe started doing that for whatever reason. Again, I don't know that any reason why you would not do it other than you really want to, like, the ideally you want to have both eyes open because you want to have all of the visual information, both peripheral and focused information you can. So if you're opening both eyes now, as long as you're not seeing a degradation of your shooting, more power to you, man. I mean, keep them both wide open and keep staring at those birds hard and target focused and keep knocking them down.
Yeah. And maybe, I guess, maybe it's just been an evolution over the years. Cause like growing up, I did a lot of target shooting and sporting clays. Over the last decade, I've hardly shot any sporting clays at all. Maybe just like once or twice in the last 5 years I have. Yeah. But outside of that, it's just been all of my shooting has just been at birds. So maybe it's been like a slow evolution of how this has happened from becoming more of a previously how I was a very target focused shooter to now coming into the real world of just shooting at birds all the time. And maybe that's kind of, you know, the bridge between the gap of why I'm starting to do this, because I don't shoot clays nearly as much. And I don't have that focus of just, you know, closing one eye and being prepared for the shot. And now everything's just in real time and it's just unfolding and I'm just letting it go naturally as it's happening. And maybe that's why I'm doing it, keeping both eyes open now.
Yeah, it sounds like if I were to try to come up with something that sounded somewhat logical, you had that habit, whether you were at the clay range or something when you were younger and somebody said, you know, close that left eye and look down, who knows, but it was a habit reflex for a long time. And now you just haven't been sort of reinforcing it. But when you're grouse hunting, you know, this, you're walking in on a point, you've got a dog on point. The last thing you're going to do is close one eye and try to walk in on your dog on point. You're looking for everything. You're trying to take in as much information as possible. So something, and like exactly like you said, just a natural extension of grouse hunting and shooting at birds, at some point that maybe your brain just kind of got rewired to where you don't have that reflex to close your left eye when the gun is coming up. And yeah, again, as long as your shooting is the same or better, that's what you want to keep doing.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe it has something to do with, too, I've kind of thought about this as well. Like before, I would always shoot a single barreled gun, whether it was an over and under I shot a little bit, or I primarily shot an autoloader. And maybe that's why I feel like I would specifically close one eye, because I had I felt like I had just a better view of vision looking straight down that barrel, where over the last 3-4 years, I've been shooting a side-by-side a lot more. And when I mount a side-by-side, you know, compared to a single barrel gun, I feel like my center of vision is just so drawn, like, naturally to that center point of the barrels. Like, it's just, I don't even have to think about it, like where my aim is going to go at. Like, my eyes just settle in that spot so naturally between those two barrels, because it's just a centerpiece that you're drawn to. You're not trying to look down a single barrel and find a bead. It's just like, it's there automatically. Like, it's just something visually that's in front of you that your eyes are drawn to naturally. And maybe now with being able to have both eyes open, my vision is just being drawn to that spot together more naturally than versus, you know, thinking I have to close one eye and get lined up down a single barrel. And that's just something I've noticed shooting a side by side the last couple of years more from switching from a single barrel gun, is just, I don't have to worry about trying to look so hard down the barrel to find the sight. My eyes are just naturally drawn to that point between the barrels.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely wanted to ask you about that, because you've pretty firmly kind of started shooting the side-by-sides, and obviously listeners of this show would know that I love shooting side-by-sides for game shooting. And I don't do the high-end target shooting and stuff, but from what I've read and heard and talking to others, you know, there's just something about game shooting. Game shooting is not really about precision like the high-end sporting clay shooters are doing, and shooting feet task and shooting 60-yard targets and little, you know, 90 millimeter birds or whatever. Like, there's a precision component to that, where the single barrel sighting plane, it seems to come in, again, from what high end shooters would say. Whereas game shooting, at the ranges that you and I are shooting at Ruffed Grouse, and the ammunition and the chokes that we're using, it's, you don't have to be razor sharp precise. And that's where I like the side-by-sides just seem to play into that sort of more fluid, just sweeping and shooting. And it's not a precision thing, whereas it's the side-by-side is just a game gun. I'm really not explaining it very well, and I don't know if it makes sense to anybody, but I think that's one of the things that I'm just sort of drawn to the side-by-side.
Yeah, I think the point you make is about spot on, because when you think about it, like exactly how you described it, like, you know, target shooting is very precision focused. But, yeah, you know, when you're shooting at a grouse, you have the, you know, ability to have a little bit of play, whether you're, you know, yeah, just a touch behind the bird, or you're, you know, you're in front of it, or you're over top of it or down below. Like, that precision doesn't necessarily define you getting the bird or not. You have the ability to be just slightly off of it and still get the bird and make a clean shot, versus, you know, feeling like you have to be dead center and making, you know, the perfect shot on it.
Yeah.
Especially like with your choke tubes, if you're shooting an open choke and, you know, a small shot, you know, you have a lot of shot in your pattern. If you can really spread that shot out, you don't have to be so precise on every shot you take.
Yeah. And I would just, it doesn't mean that we're not trying, like, it doesn't mean we're not trying to stare at the head of the grouse and place that shot perfectly, but it's not a 60-yard clay pigeon when you're shooting at a 15-yard grouse. So you got to kind of build that in. And yeah, the side-by-sides, they have a lot of characteristics that you can find in other guns as well, but just a good handling, lightweight gun that you can carry through the woods and get on the birds quickly and make those shots. I certainly enjoy it. You've been shooting the Weatherby side by side. What gauge is it? And then what do you like to shoot for shot size, ammo, that sort of thing?
It's a 20 gauge, okay. 26 inch barrel on it. And for as far as shot size, like, I'm not an ammo snob or anything by any means. I'll just shoot whatever I can find available at the store. And I'll take, you know, usually just target loads. I'll use a small game or target loads, 7.5. Sometimes I'll use 8s. But I feel like 7.5s are plenty. And especially like earlier in the year when you can get an open choke and you use an 8 or a 7.5, you have so much shot that's spread out in that pattern. You know, that helps a lot when you're using a smaller shot size. You know, you can really fill in that wide pattern compared to a larger shot, you know, shooting it through an open choke. And I think as well, I've talked about this a little bit as well, and this is maybe kind of just like my own theory that I have, and I don't know if there's any credibility to back it up, but it just makes sense in my head. You know, if you use a smaller shot size, and I've heard a few other people say this as well, you know, those 8s, 7.5s, they go through that thicker cover a lot better and don't lose their momentum going through that cover, you know, compared to like what a number 6 shot would be, because it doesn't have as much mass to hit that, you know, whatever's in front of it, like let's say a leaf, it doesn't have as much mass to go through and take away energy from that shot as it's going through and whistling through cover.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if I've ever heard it explained quite like that. What I would think, or what my mind would go to, is sending more smaller pellets through thicker cover, you're sort of increasing your, and this is kind of one of the overall concepts that I sort of choose my ammo by, is just, again, shooting at a grouse 15 to 30 yards, you've got enough energy, even in a small 8, 8.5 or 9 shot pellet, to penetrate the grouse and get the kind of penetration that you need to kill the bird. So you're increasing your chances of getting those critical hits by sending more pellets through that cover. So I would think of it more like for the same idea, but I'm sending more pellets through to get through that cover versus a pellet being able to go through that stuff easier. I would just think I'm sending more pellets through that thicker cover, but for the same general idea, I tend to shoot smaller shot size as well.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And I think what you said there is exactly what plays into it as well, because you have more shot in your pattern that's going through versus, like, let's say you're using a number 6, you obviously have less, you know, pellets in the shot, and you don't have as much, you know, as many BBs that are going through the cover as you would using, you know, an 8 or 7.5. You have more shot that's packed into that pattern. But I guess getting back to my point I was talking about a little bit there, like, let's just say a 6 compared to a 7.5. I know, like, there's not like that huge of a difference of the shot size. But a 6 has more surface area. So when you think about something going through something, you know, whatever has more surface area to it is going to, you know, lose energy more than something that has less surface area going through it. And I don't know how technical you are, like, with archery as well. But if you think about, like, a really small diameter arrow compared to, you know, some of the bigger arrows that they used to shoot back in the day, those really small diameter arrows have more penetrating power because they have less surface area to them to go through a target. It doesn't get slowed down as much because there's not as much surface for whatever it's going through to grab onto it and slow it down.
Yeah. Okay. Now I follow you, and it brings to mind something that Del Whitman told me. I suppose it would be some sort of balance between, like, a smaller pellet is going to have less actual mass, so it's going to have less energy to go through something, but maybe depending on what that is that it's going through, a smaller pellet might be able to zip through something. And I specifically remember having a conversation with Del Whitman at one time where he was talking about shooting 8.5 shot, which he kind of turned me on to that specifically for the smaller gauges, you know, the 28 gauge, when you are shooting a lighter payload, trying to keep your pellet count up to where a 7/8 ounce payload and a 20 gauge, you might be able to maintain that pellet count with 8 shot or 7.5 shot. You go down to the 28 gauge 3/4 ounce, you shoot 8.5. He felt like those 8.5s, they tend to really, like, zip through birds, and he doesn't find a lot of them in birds. And I kind of paid attention. I don't do anything, like, super analytical about monitoring that, but definitely familiar with the concept, and what you're saying makes sense to me now.
Yeah. I think that the larger shot, it produces more energy overall. But when you talk about, like, the energy that's left when it goes through something coming out the other side, I feel like that smaller shot size definitely has more energy coming out the other side because there's less surface area that's slowing it down, taking away energy as it's going through.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, it's, you can get into the weeds on the stuff we have before, but the, at the end of the day, a well-placed pattern of 6, 7.5, 8, 8.5, 9, a well-placed pattern is going to knock down a bird at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Exactly. And I've been during the early season here, I've been shooting a skeet and an improved cylinder choke. And I think okay. I might switch it up tonight for the first time actually, and go from that to just trying an improved cylinder in the first barrel to a modified in the second. Because when I did hunt the last time I grouse hunted 2 weeks ago, there was a couple times where, you know, that bird was gone pretty quickly. And on the second shot, you know, it was out there 40, 50 yards. And there's a couple times I was like, I feel like if I had a modified choke in there, I might've gotten a little bit more of a connection. You know, I tickled a couple birds a few times. I saw them kind of do a little weave through the air, but it was nothing yep. that even threw them off balance on their shot. So I think I am going to switch to a modified for this week coming up that I'm going to go hunting. That's kind of usually what I do later in the year, is I'll go to an improved cylinder to a modified in my barrels versus a skeet and improved cylinder earlier in the yep. year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I was going to ask you about chokes, and if you, obviously you've got interchangeable chokes, so you can make that switch. That's a pretty logical switch at this point in the year. We're going to wrap up here in just a minute. I was curious. I think we talked about a lot of stuff, and I think based on some of the things that I've been sort of watching you discuss in your videos, like I have an idea of kind of what kind of questions you get from people that are watching and commenters. But is it a lot of like, you know, how do you find spots? What are you looking for? Are those kind of the, a lot of the common questions that you get?
There is some of that. My most common question that's just like repeatedly pounded is just more information on my dogs and like where my dogs come from, who's the breeder on my dogs, and you know, where do I get my dogs from? And that's probably the biggest thing that I get from people asking, is wanting to know more about the dogs.
Okay. What I actually had meant to ask you that. You got Yeti. Do you have four dogs now? Like, just go through the string. We might as well answer those questions while we can.
Yeah. Yeah. We have four dogs now. They're all Brittany's. They range from 2 years old. Yeti's just over 7 years old now. So
okay.
we got Yeti. He's 7. Now we have Ember, who's turning 5 in January. Then Aspen, who just turned 4 this past Saturday on November 2nd. And then we have our youngest pup, Fox, who's just over 2 years old now.
And Fox is out of Ember, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Fox was one of the ones that we kept from a breeding that we did.
Who did you breed Ember to?
We bred Ember to Justin Berkeley's Northern Forest Gun Dogs. His male that he has for us. That's who we did the breeding.
Okay.
With.
Okay. Okay. And yeah, man, I'm telling you, like, I'm gonna end up with a Brittany one of these days. But I look at like your little dog Fox. She's just like, she's like the cutest dog in the world. But I see a lot of, you know, I have a young orange and white setter, and the similarities there. My eye is drawn to orange and white dogs like that, as much as I love my tricolor setters as well. But I see that cute little Brittany. I was chuckling in one of your videos. You cut her loose and she like leaps into the brush and you're like, wee. That's what I have in my head when I see Fox run through the covers, wee. And that's exactly what it looked like.
Yeah. That's our little mentality with her. She's just running around going, wee, wee. Cause she's got like that deer hop to her where she just takes off and it's just boing, boing, boing. And man, she's a fast little dog, and she looks so innocent when you get her up close, and she kind of rolls over and is just like, has this sweet little look to her. But man, she is just a little devil outside of that. She's very stubborn, hard-headed. She likes doing her own thing. And she's the dog that I have to like actually control and have a handle on most in the field. Because she'll get out there and she runs on a straight line, and then all of a sudden she hits that 150 yard mark, and I'm like, shit, like I got to get her back now or else she's going to be at 300-400 yards before I know it. And she's going to get turned around, and like, now I'm just going to have to sit here for a minute trying to get the dog back to me. So yeah, she's the dog that I have to have a handle on the most out in the woods, because she'll just go on a line and she'll be gone, just like she's, that.
She's kind of at that age where they do, it seems like they do kind of test you at that point too.
Yeah. She definitely, she likes to find up, like figure out what she can get away with. Not what she can't get away with, what she can get away with.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. All right, man. Well, hey, we got grouse hunting to do today. This has been fun. I just want to give you a chance to point folks towards the YouTube channel and highlight anything you got coming up, or what you want people to look for.
Yeah. I mean, you can find our YouTube channel. It's called Uplander. I haven't been able to get as many videos out this year as I have in the year past or so, just because I've been at home here, and some of the grouse hunting has just turned out to be, you know, not what I was hoping it to be. So there's a few times I've gone out where, you know, I was trying to make something or do something and it just hasn't, you know, equated into anything. But hopefully this coming week we'll have a little bit more coming out here before deer season starts. But yeah, Uplander on YouTube, we've got, you know, geez, 5 years of videos now loaded on there and quite a bit of content. So, I mean, if you're looking for, you know, something to watch that's really focused on, you know, grouse hunting and bird hunting itself, it centers around a storyline. Like I try and put together a story of everything when I'm doing it, not just like, well, you know, here's birds getting up in the air and here's me shooting at it. So I try and go through, you know, my mindset of why I'm doing something, why I'm at a location, no matter what it is that I'm hunting, and just try and tell the overall story of what's going on, how the dogs are working, how, you know, me approaching a dog is playing into it, and how everything's unfolding in front of me. So that's what I really try and focus on in the channel, is just telling a story of everything.
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, this is just me talking, but that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. It's why I do the podcast, like the thought process, you know, what are you thinking? Why are you going here? And why are you making the decisions? And I feel like you've got a really nice mix of, you utilize the GoPro, obviously, because that's kind of the core component of you're out there by yourself and it's what you got to do. But you mix in a really nice mix of B-roll and sort of vlog style stuff. So it's a good balance. It's what I appreciate about it. And I think folks that have seen it would certainly know that as well. But yeah, keep up the great work, buddy. I appreciate it. It's been fun having you on here. And I know you got a website and you got hats and shirts and all that kind of stuff too. So feel free to point folks in that direction as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All that can be found at uplanderlifestyle.com.
All right, buddy. Good luck this afternoon and the rest of your grouse season. You and I will have to keep in touch, and hope you and your dad find some success at deer camp as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully you too, man. Hopefully that buck you got hanging around out back there sticks around a little bit longer.
If only I could sling an arrow that way. He's still, he's actually up and on his feet now. So I'll have to go check the trail cams after we stop recording here.
For sure.
All right, buddy. Have a good one.
All right. Take care, man.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.